Hello. The seatbelt check is around the corner.
You actually were telling the truth.
I do that quite a lot. Your people are always surprised.
Welcome aboard. Ladies and gentlemen, there may be some turbulence up ahead. Make sure your seatbelts are fastened.
To those guests who've just joined us, welcome.
Welcome back to Escape to the Magic Podcast. We're your hosts. I'm Randy.
I'm Dak.
This is Ryan. Dak gave me a look like, hey, am I supposed to speak?
I can't remember the order we went into.
Boy, we haven't done this in so long. It was, What are we doing here for a second?
Yeah, it's been a hot minute since the three of us have been together, but it's good. Good to be back.
Yeah, it's good to have you guys travel all the way this way over to my house. It's great. Thank you. Thank you. It is good to be back, though.
It is. We missed you, Randy.
Well, listen, fellas, it's not for lack of desire. It's just, life sometimes is hard. And when you have demanding responsibilities at home and in society, sometimes that has to take the front burner, despite the fact that any given day of the week, I much rather would have been having this discussion with y'all.
Well, we call this podcast Escape to the Magic. Like, this is, you know, despite our busy lives and schedules and family commitments, work, church, like, being able to do this absolutely is an escape for, I know for me, I know for you guys, but for me, it's just to take an hour or two out of the week and just talk about this passion of ours. Like, it absolutely helps.
Yeah, it is a true escape.
Yeah.
It really is. And certainly we hope that our listeners feel that same sort of escape wherever you may listen at, whether it's in the car or at home or wherever you might find yourself. We hope that we can add just a little bit to your ability to escape.
Yeah, because we can't go to Disney every week as much as we want to.
Listen, I haven't been in so long, I don't even remember what the place looks like.
They've got castles and parades and stuff like that. Yeah.
Well, this week we're really excited actually to bring what we feel is a pretty interesting topic. We talk about escaping to the magic. We want to talk about the people who help shape the vision. So this week's episode is about the CEOs who built the magic.
Yeah, I think this is a little bit off of our beaten path of like going to the parks and what you experience there. So maybe kind of more of a roundtable discussion, if you will, about just the CEOs that Disney has gone through and their impact on the parks, on the company. So might be a little bit of a different episode, but hopefully we make it fun and entertaining and informational as well.
And, you know, something that I think is really interesting about this, when you have... First of all, this isn't meant to be just a history episode.
Right.
We really do want to have a good discussion. I'm very confident that we're going to have a pretty good, healthy discussion. But as I kind of look at something that stands out to me right away, if I'm not mistaken, there's only one, maybe two CEOs that preceded all of us in life.
Yeah, you're probably right. You're probably right there.
Yeah, I think I'm right. Now, the second one, and we'll talk about it here, is probably you were too young for Dak. Dak's the old guy here, but he's not that old. but you know, you probably don't have much life intersection with that. But in terms of just chronology, that's what's really interesting about this. When we talk about the CEOs for the company, you know, the longest tenured of those was Walt Disney, and he's the only one who was before and who passed away before any of us were alive.
Yeah. I think what's interesting here is you see, as we'll go through the list of these guys, you know, who had direct contact with Walt as well. I think that plays a big impact on how they treat the parks, what their relationship was to Walt, and just kind of his vision and being able to see that. And then, as we move through time and history, how that changed and altered things, where people respect and revere Walt, but also understand that, you know, today's company is not necessarily a direct reflection of Walt Disney himself.
So Randy makes us seem older than we really are. So
And I think that's what's so interesting about this.
Roy also died before we were born.
Well, that's why I'm saying maybe because what that year, what, 70
years old?
Or? No.
Oh, I was born in 75, so I turned 50 this year.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right. So two.
Whoa.
Two.
Please don't stop listening.
I couldn't remember. Listen, man, I was born in 81, so... You know, anything before that is ancient to me.
There you go. Well, should we get into it?
Yeah, let's do it.
We already started talking a little bit about Walt, so let's start there. Obviously, Walt, while not the CEO, he was the founder of the company. I mean, I think we all know that. Just maybe talk, each of us take a little bit of a round and talk about some of the things he accomplished, maybe some of the things he struggled with, and just kind of your overall impression. Again, he... lived and died before we were ever around, but just who you picture in your mind Walt was as a founder of this huge, what has now become this huge organization.
Yeah.
What do y'all think?
Go ahead, Randy.
I would say that this is something interesting. You know, Walt is the ultimate entrepreneur here. You really think about it and how it started. First of all, he effectively leads the company all the way from the 20s to the 60s, okay? And that's right up until his death. So he's got the biggest thumbprint on the company's vision, its strategy, you know, the shape, the direction, all of those sorts of things. His thumbprint is absolutely the biggest and most influential, and it is to this day. Obviously, it's got his name on it, right? It's the Walt Disney Company. It's not just the Disney Company, it's the Walt Disney Company, right? So never forget that part, is that Walt remains, even to this day, an integral part of everything they do. But he was the entrepreneur when you start out. You know, didn't have money, didn't have a lot of support, didn't have a lot of backing. He was always having to kind of round that up. And, you know, I've worked for an entrepreneur before who was highly driven like Walt was, who was seeking to do something, had a vision. And I think at least my perspective is this, not knowing Walt personally, but there's a lot of information out there about him. The thing that wasn't driving Walt was financial success. The vision is what drove Walt. And that's what sets him apart, I think, from a lot of other entrepreneurs who are really trying to drive a little bit more towards financial success. They've got a vision on this thing, a product, a widget, a gimmick, something that's going to work and bring them a lot of money, and that's what's kind of driving them. Walt wasn't driving towards the money. The money was going to come, and I think he understood the priorities that if I build it and it works and I do it and it works, then finances will be there to help support everything else that comes next. But I want to do this thing, and if I can do this thing, then it's going to lead to the next thing, and if I can do the next thing, and it leads to the thing after that. And I think that's the story of the Walt Disney Company. And if you look at everything that's happened and transpired all the way from starting out in animation to building, you know, hotels and resorts around the world, it's one thing has led to the next. And now you have integration. And that's the ultimate entrepreneur's dream, that you can build so many different things and you can integrate them all together and they all work. I wonder if Walt had lived longer, how much more integrated everything could have been and where financially ultimately he would have landed at the end of it. Because the reality was, is when he died, it was still just getting started. He might've led the company for 40 years, but it was still just getting started. That's how long of a row he was trying to hoe there.
You know, it's interesting that you mention about, you know, his beginnings about not really setting out to make a ton of money. He was at a point almost homeless.
Yeah.
Dirt poor, living off the streets almost. And you look at, I think of other people, these creative people like artists, musicians, painters, who usually start out relatively poor. Mm-hmm. They're in it because they have a passion for what they do. I don't know if I have the mindset to be like a Walt or like a Van Gogh or somebody that's a creative who can sit back and say, I'm going to do this. And yeah, it may take me 10 or 15 years to figure out or to get discovered. Because, I mean, Walt started really early in life with you know, conceptual drawings, you know, Oswald the Lucky Rabbit, all these things. And finally, you know, and again, this is not a history on Walt's life, but it took him a little bit. to find success. And he went, even when he was building his parks, there was times where he's like, where's this money going to come from? I'm not that successful yet.
Yep.
I don't have the like all the money yet. How am I going to make this work? So I think just to that point, Randy, Walt's vision, his tenacity, his willingness to keep going despite all the failures he had in life. One of a kind.
Yeah, that's where I was going to go is I think for me, the biggest thing that, you know, and all of my girls, you know, in elementary school, they've done studies and histories, lessons and presentations on Walt. I think just because of our love as a family for, you know, going to Disney and stuff like that. So learned a lot of his history and stories. And then, of course, my own just fanatic part of me that wants to learn more about Walt. But I think the biggest thing to me that sticks out about Walt is just his tenacious and driven attitude towards things. Like so many times he was told over and over again, this will not work. This is going to fail. This is going to flop. What you did was not going to work, right? And he just kept driving through it, right? You think about things like Snow White, and no one's going to go see a full-length animation movie. No one is, right? That's just not going to sell, and it becomes one of the highest-producing movies of its time. No one's going to go to an amusement park. They're filthy. They're dirty. Even his own wife is saying no one wants to go to those things because they're this way, and Walt just kept driving through it with the tenacity of like, no, mine's going to be different because I'm going to do this and this and this. And I just, again, Ryan, you use the word visionary. It's true. That's who he was. He always, no matter what door closed, he was like, okay, that door closed. I'm going to find another door to open to make this happen. You know, if I can't fund Disneyland, then I'm going to mortgage one of my homes because I believe in this so much that I'm going to do whatever it takes to be successful. And I think, you know, when it's your baby, I understand why he probably felt that way. Is he's like, this is my thing and I'm going to make it work. I'm going to make it happen.
That's the thing about what it, I think, really means to be the visionary, right? And entrepreneurship plays a huge role in that, because the things that made Walt work so well was that he wouldn't take no for an answer. You know, he would find a way. Just because a person or a organization or company said, no, we're not going to support, he'd find a way. He'd go figure out another way to do it. And second of all, the visionary is someone who's going to approach things differently from anyone else. I mean, that's the irony of the whole thing is everyone who told him, no, it won't work, are people who had never even tried what he was trying to do before, right? And he's out there saying, look, trust me, this is going to work. I can see it. I understand it. I know how it's going to happen. And I think a lot of it has to do with it takes someone who, in the types of things he was doing, has a really good understanding of how people work, the human element and how it goes. I mean, think about it. Why are the Disney parks so clean? Because he took the time to walk the park and say, this is how many feet you need before you have a trash can. By eating a hot dog, right? Yeah. This is how long it takes me to eat this hot dog, and that's why we need another trash can here. He approached it from a very different way than other people typically did. Engineers are going to come up with a bunch of calculations to do stuff. Walt's calculation was how many feet it took to eat a hot dog.
Yeah.
That is the sort of vision that you need to have when you say, but let's put ourselves in the shoes of our customers or of our fans or of our enthusiasts or the people who are going to be here. If we put ourselves in their shoes, what are they going to experience? And let's try and experience that at the same time so that we can elevate that experience and always have it get better. And we talked about this before previously in another episode, about plussing things. You know, Walt's vision of plussing things was simply the evolution that it's always getting better. I always want to see how it can get better. Sometimes that's adding, sometimes that's subtracting from things that maybe don't work as well as we thought. But if you don't try it, you'll never find out. You never get the data behind understanding what it is that is going to work. And if you just want to leave it on a piece of paper and walk away from it, well, you'll never find out.
Yeah. No, I totally agree. Ryan, did you have anything more on Walt?
I'm related to Walt.
Me too.
Yeah. What's your relation?
Like a ninth cousin. It's pretty deep.
So I am eighth cousin, four times removed with Walt.
Yeah, I think I'm nine, yeah. three times removed.
Yeah. Yeah. I had to point that out. I was like, I know I'm related. I thought I was a 10th cousin, but now I just looked it up. I'm eighth cousin, four times removed. Yeah. Yeah. That's my connection to Walt.
Nice. Well, let's keep moving on because we got six more of these guys to go through. But I think to kind of paint the picture, I think Walt Disney Studios, I think the animation and movie department and his live action, you know, production companies were all moving forward. Disneyland is well on its way. So I think from a...
But there were other challenges too, yeah. right? Like it wasn't all roses, you know. I mean, we allude to the fact that finances were a little bit hard, but there were other things too. There were labor strikes, right? He had visions that, frankly, if he wasn't going to drive it, were never going to come to reality. Epcot is actually... that vision.
Yeah.
The Epcot we have today wasn't the Epcot Walt Disney was proposing.
No, not at all.
And I think that's the thing about it. And I want to probably maybe leave our discussion of Walt on that note. That's what made him so unique. Only Walt Disney probably could have actually accomplished his prototype community of tomorrow. I absolutely, truly, firmly believe that had he lived longer, he probably would have needed more than just a few decades to really do it. But had he lived longer, I bet you we could have had a real life Epcot.
Yeah, he would have stuck with it.
He would have stuck with it. He wasn't going to give it up, you know. But once he was gone, the thing was, well, we're going to have to pivot because none of us really know what this is about. Nobody else had Walt's vision.
Yeah. And so I think, yeah, that and then just to kind of wrap up his life as it's coming to an end, Disney World is just coming online, right? Like not being built, but just coming online as far as acquisition of the land and the property and, you know, the vision that he had. And now insert Roy O. Disney, right? He becomes the next CEO, if you will, not really CEO, but chairman of the Disney Corporation. And he helps bring Walt Disney World into place. So basically, Roy O. ran the show from 1966 to 1971. That was his timeline. And he brings in Walt Disney World. And I personally feel, I mean, I don't know that this has ever been verified, but I think that was like kind of his dying wish, if you will, that, hey, I'm going to get Walt Disney World up and going. And then physically, emotionally, mentally, I think he was just spent and done. And I think he could kind of exhale and be like, okay, I finished my brother's vision of building this.
Well, I think he passed away like 2 months after Walt Disney World opened.
Yeah. It was very shortly after it opened. Yeah. You know, he 71, right? That's the year Walt Disney World opens. And it was pretty short. You know, you got to remember, obviously Roy's relationship with Walt was his brother, best friend, confidant, sometimes, you know, antagonistic business partner, right? Because he was the one that also had to keep Walt in check and say, listen, Walt, I get it. I know what you want to do. We're doing everything we can. We ain't got the money.
Yeah.
You know, and Walt says, go find the money. And Roy says, we ain't got the money. Go find the money. Okay, let me see what I can do, right? And what a special relationship that must have been. And particularly, you know, I hate to say it, but this will sound probably worse than I mean it to come out, right? But, you know, sometimes you have relationships with people and there's so many problems with it that once that relationship's over, you almost are like, okay, now I can move on. Roy didn't do that. He didn't move on. He pushed through, right? Because it was really challenging from a financial standpoint to do everything that they were trying to accomplish. And he pushed through it. And I think you're right, Dak. I think he literally spent everything that he had physically finishing Walt's dream. And he took it as far as he could.
Yeah. I think the other thing is like I shouldn't say all of us. If any of us have ever worked with family before, that can be very hard on a relationship. And I'm sure it was at times with these two brothers. But it seems somehow they kept that friendship and relationship alive between the two of them for Roy, like you say, for Roy to feel the need and the desire to finish this this project.
Well, it probably was good that Walt was the creative one and Roy was the financial guru. Yeah, they didn't have competing ideas. You know, like you said, Randy, Walt's like, I need money. Roy's like, we don't have it. Okay, well, find me money. I'll do my best. It wasn't like, hey, we should do this with the park. We should do this with the castle. We should do this with this attraction. Roy's like, I'll find you the money. And Walt was the creative
one. And sometimes Roy came back and he says, okay, this is how much you have. I need more. This is how much you have. You're going to have to adjust. And yeah. I think that's an interesting thing. You know, we spent a lot of time talking about Walt's entrepreneurial, tenacity, but that has to be tempered if you're going to have some of that kind of success, right? It can't just be unfettered, unlimited, go and do whatever you want to do sort of a thing. There were some constraints, and you've got to surround yourself with people who can help you, not just enablers. So I wouldn't want to paint Roy as just an enabler, because he wasn't. Roy was someone who used really sound financial management practices to keep things moving in the right direction, financing things when they could and when they needed to, but at the same time, making sure that he was able to go back to his brother and say, Walt, you just can't do that yet, right? You're going to have to take a different approach today. And maybe if you could show something, then you can build it better later. But right now, this is all we've got. And that makes you kind of do things. I mean, seriously, you know, if Walt was able to do whatever he wanted to, I promise you Sleeping Beauty Castle would have been much larger. Think about it, right? But you have to do things at a scale that you could accomplish at the time. You know in his mind that castle was larger than life. And you know when you get to Disneyland and you look at that, you say, huh, that's not what I was expecting the first time, right? But of course, the best part is then you get inside of it and you're like, well, this is much bigger than I thought. So it's that balance, the creative and the business management, the financial practices. You got to have a good balance if you're going to have that success. That's what Roy brought to the table, not the creative, but he was the one that made sure that it could actually happen, because money is what makes this work.
And if you go to Disney World, there is a statue there of Roy. With Mickey, right there in front of the castle.
Yep.
So, not in front of the castle, the flagpole.
Yeah. Sorry. Yeah.
So one funny story is, and we'll get to him, but at Disney World, you know, all the windows along Main Street have influential individuals that help with, you know, building the park or, you know, their role at the Disney Corporation. And Card Walker has a window, and his is called the Justice of the Peace, right? And so what's interesting about that is I've heard stories when I went on our Keys to the Kingdom tour, the story behind that is that Card would say, hey, Roy, I need you to come down to the offices. I need you to sign some papers. Okay, I'll be down at 7. Great. Hey, Walt, I need you here at 7 to sign some paperwork to get through some of the things we need to do, because at the time Walt and Roy were butting heads so much.
They wouldn't talk to each other.
They weren't even talking to each other. And so Card would set up these meetings between the two of them, unbeknownst to the other one, to help them work out their differences. So you're right. Roy didn't lay down. He stood his ground on his financial, you know, keeping the company in check, which is absolutely needed. Walt was not going to bend on his creativity. And so you're right. Sometimes they just had to get in a room and hash it out and make it work. And that's, to me, that's what I think pushes people like Imagineers to expand their creative minds. It's like, well, you can't just have this unlimited budget. You have to work within these constraints. And so make it work and make it entertaining and be creative with how you can do things. Anyways. Let's keep moving on. So Roy passes, and then our next person on the list is a gentleman by the name of Don Tatum. I think what's interesting about Don is that obviously he was there with both of them as well, but he now becomes the first non-Disney family member to run the company. And he does some amazing things. He keeps the business going and keeps it thriving. One other thing he ended up doing, I didn't know this until we started doing some research, but he opened up the Lake Buena Vista Shopping Village in 1975, which would later become Downtown Disney and then eventually Disney Springs.
Yeah.
So I didn't know that about Don.
Which is, here we go. It's the next foray into the evolution of the company, right? We start in animation. Now we get into theme parks. Then we get into hotels, right? The, yeah. You know, that's a different episode we've covered before, but the Disneyland Hotel and the relationship it had there, right? So now we get into hotels, and now we build Walt Disney World, which is going to become a full resort, right? And what else do you need for a full resort? You need some shopping, you know, it's external shopping. It creates a shopping village, yet another opportunity to expand the footprint, the brand, and the opportunities for success.
Yeah, I mean, it's Ryan, did you have anything on Don before we? I mean, that's really it.
That's really it.
he served. He, you know, sat in that role from 1971 to 1976. And then, speaking of Card Walker, along comes Card Walker. He becomes the next CEO of the company. He picks up in 1976, and Don stays on as a chairman until 1980.
And this is when you finally kind of start to see, I think, a little bit of the division in how leadership for the corporation works, right?
For sure.
So with this diversification, now you don't really just have one company doing kind of a couple of things. You have a company that's really starting to branch out. So from a corporate organizational model, you've got to start thinking bigger picture how this works. You've got a board, you've got shareholders and investors, you've got a lot of interested parties, and someone's got to lead that. And what more natural transition could you have than the person who was serving as CEO now to become the board chairperson, and you bring in another CEO to run the day-to-day operations?
Yeah, and Card was more business-minded. So I would say he was very much more Roy O. style of being very business-minded, but like you said, also had the vision of like, okay, let's really grow this thing. And this is where we start to see some of the big growth. You know, he was there 76 to 83. We start to see a big growth in things like Epcot. So he helped open Epcot. He expanded to the television. So Disney, the Disney Channel.
Huge.
Yeah, that's a huge.
Huge. Its own dedicated network. Remember, Walt had a special hour. Okay.
Right.
On Sunday nights. Now, all of a sudden, they've got their own entire network. Yeah. Unheard of.
I remember, just like going back down memory lane, as a kid growing up, if one of your friends, we didn't, but if one of your friends had the Disney Channel,
yeah,
like you were parked in their living room because it was just so mind-blowing that you could get Disney all the time instead of that Sunday night, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Walt Disney Presents. I don't remember the Disney Channel in the 80s.
Oh, really?
No, I don't at all.
Well,
that's weird. We didn't have cable, so.
That was the thing, right? Again, yeah. You're talking about 1980s. I mean,
it's 83. In fact, he launches it. It's his last year as CEO is when the Disney Channel launches.
Yeah, I mean, cable is just coming online. But again, to have the foresight and the knowledge of saying, this cable thing is going to go somewhere, right? Like people had gone from 5 channels to 20 channels, and it just seemed overwhelming. But anyways, we don't want to deep dive into some of these things. The other thing I would say, I deep dive too much is what I'm trying to say. The other thing I think that was instrumental is he helps bring on Tokyo Disneyland. Mm. So now Tokyo Disneyland helps Disney really become this global icon that that we know it as today. That I think that's the hardest part about some of these things is you go back and we're looking at it through the lens of the Disney Corporation 2025. We forget how infant stages some of these things were as far as like you really want to build a park overseas. That's going to be a huge challenge. And just working through that as a CEO to figure out how can we do things and how can we also be building Epcot at the same time? It's like you're really taking your imagineering force and you're splitting it in half to have these two simultaneous parks being built and how to manage that.
Think about it this way, right? The first 25 years of the company, almost 25 years, 1923 to 1955, the company was focused on movies. animated movies.
Yeah.
That was the focus. You know, Walt got into some other things too. You know, he had his Sunday night specials. They did a lot of the animal kind of biographies and stuff like that, that Walt loved so much, but their focus was visual media. And now all of a sudden 55 Disneyland opens, and now you've got two things going on, but you've got Disneyland is the only part for the next 15 years until Disney World opens in 71. And so now you've got American media on the big screen. You've got a little bit on the small screen. You've got a couple of parks on both coasts. And it's not till 83 where all of a sudden we expand beyond just the borders of the United States. And you're starting to see the evolution of what happens. And now a bunch of things happen. But think about that. 1923 all the way to 1983, the footprint was really small.
Yeah.
And this is where it just starts to take off on a really powerful scale, because 23 to 83 is a lot longer from 83 to 25 right now.
Yeah.
That's we're basically in the same spot.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, and I think it's worth noting too, as we've talked about these past two CEOs, Don Tatum and Card Walker, you know, these really were two gentlemen who kind of carried the theme or the mantra of what would Walt do. They had a personal connection with Walt, and kind of, you know, again, not trying to say this is a bad thing, but, you know, they really did lack a little innovation, right? They just, what would Walt do? They played it safe.
Yeah.
They didn't want to do anything that was too risky. You know, Tokyo Disney was probably the riskiest thing, like you said. I mean, it's a completely different continent, right? Let's build a park somewhere else that's not in the U.S. But, you know, these guys, just what would Walt do was kind of their theme. And, you know, I think for example, you talk about the animation studios. Well, the animation studios were taking a hit. They were not putting out a lot of good.
Yeah, and you gotta bring that up,
good,
right?
Movies.
So
yeah.
The focus had become so much on parks and in-person entertainment that the media side of the company really, really was struggling at this point.
Yeah.
In fact, they put out some they put out some things that just weren't good at all, right? The Black Cauldron,
yeah,
just no good.
I mean, name a movie that
spent
came
a
out,
lot of money on it.
Name
no
a movie
good.
That came out in the '70s that you can, off the top of your head, that you can think of, other than the Black Cauldron.
Movies, none. It was more
that was 85.
Not even, like,
hey,
not
well,
even,
there you go.
Yeah, not even the shorts, like the old Mickey cartoons, Disney. I mean, Donald Duck, Disney shorts, and those things. Those all were 50s and 60s. You're right, Ryan. Everything kind of like faded out in that.
And there was, and what this did was it created some real concern among investors of, okay, we don't have a Disney at the helm of the company right now. Are we going to be able to keep this magic that we started?
Yeah.
And I think that has a lot to do with why the next CEO who comes in is who it was. We're talking about Ron Miller.
Yeah.
The shortest tenured CEO in the company's history. Even shorter than the last guy we had before the guy now. And we'll get to that. But real short tenure. Ron Miller, Walt's son-in-law.
Yeah. So met Walt's daughter on a blind date, I think at USC or some crazy story like that. Really, I mean, from the get-go, just you could see that this was maybe he got out a little bit over his skis and couldn't handle the company at the stage that it was in. Who knows? Maybe prior to that, if he would have, you know, come online earlier, he could have handled. But I think it had grown enough to where it just was too much for him based on his skill set.
The expectations were unreasonable.
Yeah.
For his experience and for where the company was at the time. And, you know, I think if you would take away some of the challenges the company had gone through in terms of where its corporate strategy was, you know, it was so invested in parks. It was doing so poorly in media that, you know, investors are saying, hey, we have a return that is due to us at some point here and you guys are bleeding money.
Yeah.
And I think, and now they're saying, okay, well, look, Ron, you should know what's going on here. You were there. You should get this. You should understand it. For whatever reason, it just wasn't going to work out. And there was a pretty hostile takeover bid from outside investors that effectively ended Ron's tenure.
Yeah, I think that was,
but don't forget, I also want to say, but he had a pretty major success along the way, I think, that really kind of helps shape the future of the company too.
Oh, for sure, yeah.
And that is Touchstone Pictures. Yes,
100%. That was a huge win for him, I think, just being fair to him, that he brought on this other production company that was not necessarily the family cartoon. It allowed them to bring in different movie genres that Disney had not ventured out into before without tarnishing the Disney name.
That's right.
And so Touchstone becomes this great opportunity for the company to expand its reach in a different direction.
Yeah, let me defend Ron Miller for a second. So I think the natural inclination when you hear Ron Miller is what we've kind of hit on, is that, oh, he's a short tenured CEO, kind of got a bad rap, in my opinion, based on a lot of the things that I've been studying about Ron over the recent time. You know, Walt loved him. There is a story that when Walt was kind of in his last days of life, Ron and his wife Diane go to visit him in the hospital, and they enter the room, and Walt says to the nurse, "Hey, let me introduce you to my son, Ron." And the nurse is like, "Oh, you mean your son-in-law?" He's like, "No, this is my son." And I think that's kind of a testament to who he thought Ron was. But up until he was president of the studios for about 3 to 4 years before he became CEO. But a lot of that decline started before he was CEO.
Oh, yeah.
The animation department was absolute crap during Walker and Don Tatum's years. So that stock price had come down. And unfortunately, he was a victim of, and you know, what's his name? Basically the inventor of Greenmail. You know what I'm talking about?
How old do you think I am?
So he was a corporate raider in the 70s and 80s. He made his living on basically threatening to take over big companies.
Oh, yeah. I know who you're talking about. I remember his name.
Steinbrenner. Yeah. It's not Steinbrenner, but it's...
But he was like that.
He was like that. And rarely would he actually take over companies. He would just threaten to take over companies. Yeah. And that's what happened to Ron Miller. He's like, "Hey, listen, your stock price is in the tank right now. I've got plenty of investors that are with me, plenty of shareholders that are with me. We're going to buy up all these shares and take over your company."
Yeah.
And it turned out, I mean, this was a legal way to do it. He's like, "No, you can now pay me a premium for the shares that we're going to buy," which is what happened to Ron Miller. He had to buy this guy out to prevent him from taking over the company. So in a sense, he kind of sacrificed himself and his CEO position to save the company from being taken over.
I think that's super important too. And that's an admirable job of defending Ron. I think you're absolutely right. I think he gets a bad rap. Yeah. If you put Ron in most any other time, I bet he finds a lot more success. But there were a lot of things that bubbled up right to this point where it made it really hard. And we probably don't give him as much credit how he handled things. He was pretty savvy.
He was.
But maybe not quite savvy enough. Yeah. And I think that's seen by who comes in next, someone who is super savvy. And most importantly, and you'll finish talking about Ron here in a second, but most importantly, the biggest difference is when Michael Eisner comes in, he doesn't come alone.
Yeah.
He comes with Frank Wells. And for the first time, then you have back to this Walt and Roy relationship. You had to have that balance. And that's why I talked about it early on and why I think it's so important. You have to have that balance. All of these other fellas, they really were kind of left to go it alone. There wasn't a strong number two at the time to say, "Hey, here's how we're going to do it." Everyone who could have even been considered a number two had their own responsibilities as a number one over division, just like Ron did over animation at the time, right? If Ron had been Card Walker's COO, maybe things would have been different. They could have done other stuff, but he was focused over here on already a troubled and dying division of the company at the time.
Yeah, you know, Ron was not it wasn't nepotism. Like, he was Walt's son-in-law, but, you know, there's a story out there where, you know, he played football. He played football at USC, went to play for the Rams. And during one of the Rams games, he got just knocked out. He got back when football used to be football, you know, helmets had the one bar and that was it. he got knocked the crap out. And Walt is seeing this. He's like, I cannot have my grandchildren being raised by a guy that can't think, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So he approached her. He's like, hey, instead of getting your knocked out every Sunday, come work for me.
Instead of getting your clock cleaned.
Yeah. Yeah.
Your bell rung.
Your bell rung. Yeah. I want to say something else. And he didn't put him like in like upper management. He's like, hey, you're going to start off as a scrub.
Yeah.
And he was running plans. So back when they were building Disneyland, he was running blueprints from the office building down to Disneyland. That was kind of his job.
I did not know that.
Yeah. So last little tidbit about Ron Miller. Without him, there may not be a Pixar. Really? There may not be Tron. Because he was the one that pushed for digital animation.
He's yeah, like, I agree.
He wanted digital animation. He wanted to get into that kind of genre of movie making.
I think there's not a Michael Eisner, to tell you the truth, right? I think that Touchstone is one of those things that helped the company reinvigorate in a way where it made sense to bring a media expert in like Michael Eisner. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned for part two of our discussion, The CEOs Who Built the Magic. Coming to you next week, we'll talk about Michael Eisner, Bob Iger, and the days of infamy. Right? The days of infamy, fella? That's what we'll... I don't know. I probably won't use that phrase, but we'll keep the discussion going next week. Thanks for staying with us, y'all.
Thanks for listening, everyone.